KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the hour, our commentary on pro-Palestinian protests across the United States. But before that, rural America is Trump country. In 2016, Hillary got barely 30% of the rural vote. Biden did only a little better in 2020. But he can do a lot better than that this year, and he needs to if he's going to carry some of the swing states. Anthony Flaccavento will explain. He's a co-founder and the executive director of the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative. Plus, your Minnesota moment. We'll talk about how pro-Palestinian protesters made a deal to shut down their encampment at the University of Minnesota in exchange for the university agreeing to take steps in response to their demands. But first, today's political update with Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of The American Prospect. One note, this segment was recorded on Wednesday afternoon before the police attack on the pro-Palestine encampment at UCLA, where more than 130 people were arrested in the early morning hours on Thursday. This was after thousands of supporters gathered at the encampment outside Royce Hall earlier on Wednesday evening. That came the night after a pro-Israel mob of 200 people invaded the campus and attacked the encampment. This was Tuesday night when the police stood by and did nothing for more than 2 hours and then intervened to stop the attack, but they did not arrest any of the attackers. So Tuesday night, the university failed to protect students from attack by a pro-Israel mob. Wednesday night, the police attacked the camp themselves. Here's my conversation with Harold Meyerson, recorded after the first night, but before the second. Well, we need to start with the campus protests over Israel's destruction of Gaza. At UCLA, in the middle of the night Tuesday, a group of pro-Israel militants who were not students came on campus and attacked the Gaza protest camp. The university called the LAPD, which along with UCLA and the California UCLA police and the California Highway Patrol arrived, but they videos shot last that night show them just standing around for more than 2 hours while the people in the Gaza camp were beaten and pepper sprayed by the Zionist mob, let's call it. Police did not arrest any of the attackers. You can see the video at filmthepolicela.com, posted on Twitter. Governor Gavin Newsom condemned the police for, quote, a limited and delayed response, close quote, to the attack. David Myers, a professor of Jewish history at UCLA, who's been a guest on this show, called it, quote, the darkest day in my 32 years at UCLA, close quote. He called the situation a, quote, complete and total systems failure at the university, city, and state levels. And he asked, why didn't the police, UC police, and the LA police show up? Those in the encampment were defenseless in the face of a violent band of thugs, and no one, wherever they stand politically, is safer today. David Myers, history professor at UCLA. So at UCLA, Tuesday night, we had a violent Zionist mob coming on campus to attack a peaceful pro-Palestinian protest. This seems to be different from what's happening on other campuses.
Yeah, there's a lot of action going on campuses, for better and worse. One of the things that is still unclear to a certain degree about what happened at UCLA is that generally all of the UC campuses, notably Berkeley, which is, you know, the supposedly the epicenter of all college disruption, have basically taken the attitude that it's okay. There has not been major pushback at the UC campuses.
It's okay to have an encampment in the center of campus,
yes,
as long
yes.
as they don't disrupt classes.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, if you look at Berkeley, the effect of the encampment there is negligible compared to, let us say, the strike of TAs and RAs of last year. And Berkeley says, okay, fine, just another day in Berkeley, which is certainly not the response taken by some university presidents at Columbia and USC. So the UCLA question, which is still not, I think, entirely resolved, is that the UCs generally have been not calling in the cops, and whether this was simply a misapplication of that generally sensible rule when it no longer made any sense at all, or whether it was specifically biased against the demonstrators against Gaza, the Israel's war on Gaza, has yet to be determined. But we do know that the non-action was calamitous. That much we know.
And I think it's also new that we have an organized mob coming from off campus, not students, not otherwise connected to the university, attacking a group of students in the middle of the night. That's also pretty much unprecedented, certainly here in LA.
Well, Los Angeles, and I'm getting back into my own LA history here, Los Angeles was a pretty good outpost way back in the day of the Jewish Defense League, which was a violent organization. And I remember a quasi attack they once raised in Roxbury Park in Beverly Hills. I was there with my then quite little girl, my daughter, which was being sort of Stanley Scheinbaum, who had led the first delegation of American Jews to talk to PLO leaders, was sort of giving a presentation as to what he did, and JDL types sort of attacked that rally. So LA kind of has a history of an indigenous Jewish ultra-nationalist right, which can be populated by thugs. Although, the administrations that have cracked down on the pro-Palestinian activists often say that they're not really students either. They come from off campus. That was certainly the statement of Columbia's president.
Yeah, so we need a contrast here. UCLA, yeah, where they didn't call the cops and let the off-campus thugs attack the protesters, and Columbia, where they called the police to attack the protesters.
Yeah, well, Columbia, for me, Columbia crossed the line when it attacked the protesters already long past a week ago,
yeah,
who simply had the encampment on South Lawn, as we Columbia alum learned to refer to it. Occupying Hamilton Hall, was certainly an escalation. But Columbia has been sort of woe begotten ever since their president, who had no particular track record actually running an organization with students, went to testify before Congress, agreed to some remarkably intimidating, ludicrous remarks from Republican Congress members, and then proceeded to call in the cops to get rid of the encampment. The cops actually at Columbia last night were a good deal.
I should say we're speaking here on Wednesday, so this was Tuesday night.
The cops came into Columbia on Tuesday night were actually a good deal more restrained and orderly than the cops who descended on the encampment last week, not to mention the cops who ran amok in 1968. So there's been occasionally police have been compelled to have a learning curve, yes, this is definitely compare and contrast week on many university campuses.
And the other one we have to compare and contrast it to is USC, which has had to cancel its main commencement ceremony because, will you explain why?
Well, The faculty committee selecting a valedictorian selected a young woman who apparently made the president of the university nervous because she would have made the undergraduate valedictorian address at commencement. So
And what the nervous making fact was, as far as I can tell, the only thing was that she was Muslim.
Yeah, she's not Palestinian. Her parents come from somewhere in East Asia, as I recall correctly.
Yes, and she's not an activist militant. She's not a spokesman right. for Palestinian liberation. She's yeah. a Muslim valedictorian.
Yeah, majoring in engineering. She did have a minor in something like genocide studies, but you know that's the kind of minor that universities create these days. But you know, she was vetoed even before I think she had actually written out a speech.
Correct.
Some of the more prominent honorary recipients of degrees that would have been the commencement ceremony said, "Well, this being the case, we're not coming." And then it sort of cascaded into the fact that the university at that point had decided to simply cancel the entire university-wide graduation ceremonies. And it's not clear how many of these sort of departmental graduation ceremonies are going to happen either. So this is
another kind of overreaction by a president not calling the police, but banning a Muslim student from being the valedictorian speaker.
Yeah, well, let's keep in mind that there are sort of two looming presumed menaces hanging over university presidents. The president of Columbia experienced a congressional variety of that. Even after she called in the cops for the encampment on South Lawn, you still had House Speaker Mike Johnson, and other folks coming up.
Elise Stefanik, leading a delegation of Republican Congress members from the state of New York.
Yes, and Elise Stefanik is still auditioning for the role of Donald Trump's vice presidential pick. So that's her motivation. They're calling for getting rid of the president. And then you have...
Let's just say the president of Colombia did everything they wanted, agreed with everything they said, called the cops, and they still say, that's not enough, you should quit.
Well, that's normal Republican behavior these days. Okay. But there's also another set of looming presumed menaces, and that is major donors of universities, such as Bill Ackman, who took it upon himself to get rid of Claudine Gay as the president of Harvard. And university trustees often tend to pay heed to their mega donors. And so, you know, USC certainly has been the beneficiary of that kind of donor. It was for decades, no longer, but it was for decades, you know, the go-to school of kids who couldn't get into Stanford, whose parents were the Southern California Republican establishment. So, you know, I think we're seeing... presidents caving on several fronts to several different pressure groups. And certainly if you look at both the presidents of Columbia and USC, you can see that most likely in action.
On the other hand, we have many campuses where peaceful student protest, including encampments on the campus green, are accepted as long as they don't interfere with classes or otherwise disrupt the functioning of the university. You said Berkeley is a good example. The Brown University has gone one step further. They reached an agreement Tuesday with their protesters that demonstrators agreed to close their encampment if administrators considered divestment from Israel in October. This seems to be the first time an American college has agreed to the demands to consider disinvestment in Israel.
Yeah, and I would add there's a little complexity here because a lot of universities' investments in Israel are through, exchange-traded funds it's less an investment directly in Israeli company, but an investment into a stock market fund, which may have stocks in 250 different companies. So it just given the reality of what investment looks like today, there's that element of complexity. But that said, obviously what Brown did certainly defuses the kind of thing that erupted at Columbia at least.
And they didn't say they would divest from all companies doing business in Israel. They said they would consider it. And
right.
Very moderate of the students to accept that as a response to their demand.
I will say that it is easier to divest from an investment in Israel, given what American companies do, than to divest an investment in China, which is known as a rather prominent worker exploiter, particularly if you're a member of a minority group in China. But American capital is so wedded to China and low-wage labor that would be much harder for a university.
So let me just remind our listeners, we are recording this on Wednesday afternoon. This story is going to continue to develop. The political leadership, both of the university, the university president, the mayor of Los Angeles, the governor of California, are all pushing for investigations of various kinds of who failed to do what to protect student free speech. We'll hear a lot more about this in the coming days.
I would add one other elected figure to your list of people who at some level have to respond to this. I would say that that person is Joe Biden, because the one thing that the United States government could clearly do has nothing to do with divestment, has everything to do with simply conditioning aid on Israel. And, you know, I mean, even now, as Secretary of State Tony Blinken is zipping around the Middle East trying to arrange for a ceasefire, you have Bibi Netanyahu saying, well, ceasefire, no, we're going to invade Rafah, which is the one thing that the Biden people have repeatedly asked him not to do. I mean, I don't know what it takes to get Biden to make aid to Israel conditional, but he is certainly, could diffuse something or other if he did that. Now, I would also add that he's going to be under political pressure. He already is under political pressure to denounce, Palestinian, pro-Palestinian demonstrators when they have done things like occupy a building at Columbia. And if you actually watch the three big cable news stations, as I did last night during the Columbia, police action, CNN carried it throughout. MSNBC switched away. I think, even though it has some very intelligent commentators like the New York Times' Michelle Goldberg, they switched away after 10 p.m. Eastern, I think because they thought it wasn't actually helpful to the Democrats' storyline, whereas Fox News kept running it. And that suggests, the kind of backlash that the nation experienced in the wake of anti-war protests in the 1960s and early 70s. However, for that reason, I think, awful as it was, what happened at UCLA makes a Biden address on these matters a little easier for him, because he can now condemn what he could say is a violence and disruption on both sides, which goes down better with the Democratic base than simply going after the students who've been demonstrating against the Gaza war. So,
but of course, the story from UCLA is not really violence on both sides, which should be condemned. It's an off-campus mob of violent Zionists attacking students exercising a peaceful right to free speech.
That's correct. But from the point of view at which Biden would have to address the country anyway, as I fear he will, about the student protests, it gives him an, on the other hand, we also condemn this, which is a more even-handed thing than he might be saying were that not the case. That is the only faintly silver lining I see to what happened at UCLA.
It is interesting that the governor, Gavin Newsom, has, let us say, raised questions about, challenged the police response in failing to protect the free speech of demonstrators rather than just condemning the violence on both sides?
Yeah, well, in UCLA alone, there wasn't violence on both sides. From Biden's point of view, he's got to talk about the whole country.
Yes.
And that's different. But Newsom was certainly absolutely right to say what he said.
Well, now it's time for news of the class struggle in California, regular feature of this broadcast. The hotel strike is over in Santa Monica. The last four hotels where workers were on strike in Santa Monica reached a settlement early this week. The Hampton Inn, the Courtyard, the Viceroy, Le Meridien, and the Proper Hotel joined Fairmont Miramar and Le Marigot Santa Monica, with both settled earlier this year. So all of the struck hotels in Santa Monica have now settled the strike that began last summer. Now there's a total of 46 hotels with union negotiating new contracts with Unite Here Local 11. A whole bunch of them just signed last week in Long Beach, in Pasadena, in Manhattan Beach, and downtown. The new contract, according to the union, has the largest economic increases of any industry-wide contract in the last 30 years. $5 an hour raise in the first year that will give workers a total the first year of $10,400 more. That is a lot of money if you are a low-wage worker. And there will be 40 to 50% wage increases over the 4.5-year term of the new contract. This is for non-tipped workers. Most room attendants will earn $35 an hour by July 1st, 2027. They also got guaranteed pre-pandemic staffing levels. They got one of the highest paid pension plans for service workers in the nation. They got 50 pages of other stuff that we do not have time to go through. Unite Here, Local 11, and their community allies include Clergy and Laity United. How did they do it?
They did it in a number of ways, and it took a long time. They'd already won settlements in most of the downtown hotels and the Beverly Hills hotels, and most, though not all, of the Hollywood area hotels. They still have, I think, about a dozen hotels, some at the airport, some in Orange County, which have yet to sign. I think if I remember correctly, the first hotel that signed was the Bonaventure way back last summer, actually.
Yeah.
And they all are signatories to this same across the board contract. I should just note in general that some years ago, I was looking at area contracts that the hotel union nationally has been able to win. And it's largely, it's a function of several things, but above all, it's a function of density. What share of the hotels in that particular city are unionized? If it's a small share, you know, they tend to win less good contracts. In New York and San Francisco, where they have long had the vast majority of hotels under contract, they win the best contracts, along with, you know, their major center of power, which is Las Vegas, where they have long been able to have under contract all of the major hotels on the so-called Vegas Strip, but are still fighting to win contracts at some of the now major hotels that are not on the Strip.
One more thing about the hotel contract here in LA. It expires January 15th, 2028, just before the Olympics come to LA. Would you care to comment on the significance of that?
That is when they have the hotels over a barrel. That's obvious. That's smart. Smart timing on the union's part, though, you know, it didn't take an advanced degree to realize that that would be the best time for their contracts to expire.
I'm amazed that the hotels agreed to that, because they know as well as you and I do.
But see, that's a sign of union power. Plus which, the hotels also know that they can boost their rates tremendously throughout 2008 as a result of the Olympics. So
throughout 2028.
28, that, yes, 2028.
Finally, news of Donald Trump. Trump has been arguing at the Supreme Court that presidents should be immune from prosecution, and former presidents should be immune from prosecution. But on the campaign trail, he says that if he wins, he will prosecute Joe Biden. Isn't Trump contradicting himself?
Yes, which is, but it would only be a contradiction for Trump if he didn't contradict himself.
Do you think Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito could come up with an argument that it is constitutional to say Trump cannot be prosecuted, but Biden can?
Yes. In a nanosecond, they are capable of producing that, given just what they were saying and what their most of the other Republican justices were saying at the immunity hearing that the court held last week, in which they basically ignored the facts of the case completely and went to hypotheticals under which they could find reasons to exonerate Trump.
Well, maybe their argument would be Trump is special.
Yes. Yes. Well, as I wrote in the day that the oral arguments were held, I wrote later that day, if you look at the Supreme Court, the building, over the front doors on the outside, the words chiseled into the marble are equal justice under law. Obviously, they're going to have to do some more chiseling, as it were, justify the opinion that they're going to come forth with to say, well, except Trump under the following circumstances.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Thank you, Harold.
Always good to be here, John.
And just a reminder, that segment with Harold Meyerson was recorded on Wednesday afternoon before the police attack on the pro-Palestinian encampment at UCLA. Now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Minnesota have negotiated a deal with the president of the university. In response, they agreed to disband their encampment on campus. Student groups have been calling on the U to divest from companies with ties to Israel and the on-campus recruiting by those companies, establish ties with at least one Palestinian university, and the demands also included amnesty for people arrested during protests. The university's acting president announced Wednesday that, quote, the student coalition has agreed they will not organize disruptions at upcoming final exams and commencements, allowing those activities to continue as planned, close quote. In exchange, the acting president made public a copy of an agreement with the student group's requests and promising to hold additional meetings with their leaders. The agreement said that the University of Minnesota will make a good faith effort to provide information about its holdings in public companies dealing with Israel, to allow students to speak to the Board of Regents meeting next week about divestment. The agreement also said the university will not ban employers from campus, but will allow protest leaders to meet with career services officers to discuss appropriate mechanisms you could use to advocate to other students around their choices of potential employers. That's a quote. It also said they will allow students to work with people running international programs, quote, to explore a program affiliation with one or more Palestinian universities. And finally, the agreement said the university, quote, will commit to advocate to the Minneapolis City Attorney for lenient remedies for those previously arrested in connection with last week's encampment. After the agreement was announced, the student group said they would, quote, remain steadfast in our commitment to demanding full divestment from apartheid Israel and all entities complicit in human rights violations. We will continue fighting for all six of our demands until they are met, close quote. This has been your Minnesota Moment, a special feature of this broadcast. Thank you. It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left.
Rural America is Trump country. A lot of Democratic campaigns have conceded rural voters to the Republicans and focused on campaigning in cities and suburbs. But if Democrats could get more rural votes, especially in swing states, they could reelect Joe Biden, reclaim the House, retain the Senate. How to do that? For some answers, we turn to Anthony Flaccavento. He's an organic farmer and rural development consultant and co-founder of the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative. He's also author of the book, Building a Healthy Economy from the Bottom Up, Harnessing Real World Experience for Transformative Change. And he's a contributor to The Nation. We reached him today in Abington in Southwest Virginia. Anthony Flaccavento, welcome to the program.
So happy to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
Congressional district in Southwest rural Virginia, where you live, had a Democratic congressman for 28 years until 2012. Now the district is more than 70% Republican. You ran for that congressional seat as a Democrat in 2012 and in 2018. How do you explain its transformation from purple to deep red? What happened? Why did people there vote for Trump?
Yeah, it seemed sudden at the time. Rick Boucher was that Democratic candidate for 28 years. He's a friend of mine, and he was kind of the consummate politician who brought home the bacon. He had positions on all the major issues, but he was known by Democrats, independents, and Republicans as somebody whose driving force was making the district better. So he's a constituent politician. That's part of why he lasted as long as he did. But what happened actually was 2010 at the Tea Party wave when he lost his seat. The same Republican incumbent has been in since, same guy I ran against. And what seemed to be an abrupt shift was actually something that had been brewing in the 9th District of Virginia and across rural America for the better part of three decades at that point. And essentially it was this: the economy had shifted so dramatically and really worn down and hollowed out big chunks of rural America, small towns with manufacturing and all of that. And that process was really aided and abetted by both Republicans and Democrats. That trickle down, globalization, investor-driven trade junk was really a bipartisan consensus that led to that. Now, the Democrats always wanted to soften the blow a little more than the Republicans, but Bill Clinton signed NAFTA. Bill Clinton was with the Republicans in opening the WTO to China. Barack Obama essentially sat on the sidelines while corporate mergers went on and on. The definition of antitrust shifted to one that was so narrow and pathetic that corporations had the rule. And both Republicans and Democrats stood by, either enabling it or actually actively pursuing it. So from the perspective of millions of working class and rural people, what they saw was two parties who really abandoned them, their jobs, their livelihoods. But while both parties abandoned them, the Republicans got damn good at talking to them and really recognizing the anger. Now, in many ways, stoking it and with half-truths and lies, but they recognized it. They said, you people have been screwed. You've been left out. The liberal establishment doesn't care about you. They make fun of you. And that is all basically true. The Democratic response to this, like I say, was a little softer around the edges with more safety nets, but for the most part was to say, well, sorry, folks, that's what progress is about. So you better either get with the program and get a college degree and become either in the financial management industry or a coder, or you should move to the city. So you had two parties that betrayed rural and working class economically, but one party said, we feel for you. And the other party said, suck it up. So in a sort of simplified way, that's how we got to this point.
Well, Democrats used to do a lot better with rural voters. I learned from your piece in The Nation that in 2008, Barack Obama won 45% of rural voters nationwide. In 2016, Hillary got barely 30%. So the big change comes with Trump, but how much of the blame goes to Hillary herself and her campaign?
Well, I'd say a goodly bit. But again, Hillary Clinton was not an anomaly. She was just a culmination of really what had happened. And Obama's 45% was a blip because the Democratic Party had been losing ground for a generation at that point. But what Obama did in his first campaign was he went to Iowa. He came to Abingdon, where I am. He came to Appalachia. And he seemed to genuinely say to coal miners, to farmers, to people in manufacturing, we care about you. The system hasn't worked for you. We're going to change that. But one of the things he did that really won him Iowa was he held meetings with farmers around some obscure but critical law called the Packers and Stockyards Act, which is this law that governs the relationship between Tyson and the big ag conglomerates and the farmers they contract with. And he said, this law isn't fair to you. It gives all the power to the corporations and all the liability to you. We're going to change that. But when he got into office, he and Tom Vilsack just got beaten back by the corporate ag lobby, and they let it go. So Obama surged because he showed that kind of empathy that people in rural were longing for. But when he got into office, he didn't follow through.
Your Rural Urban Bridge Initiative did a big study of candidates running in rural America who overperformed, in quotation marks. That is, they got more votes than the average, more votes than expected. So we want to learn from them and from your findings about what does it take to win more votes. Maybe not a majority, but more will help Biden a lot, especially in those swing states where the margins are 20,000, 40,000 votes.
Yeah, that study came out in the fall of 2022, and it was based on interviews with 50 Democrats who ran in rural in 25 different states, and as you say, overperformed. Actually, a fair number of them won, but majority just beat the partisan lean. Here's the essential takeaways from that. It's more than this, but this is it. Number one, the successful candidates were laser focused on local issues. They had positions on everything from, you know, trade policy to abortion, but over and over, they stayed focused on the issues of their district, and people felt heard. Secondly, they were themselves overwhelmingly local people. We referred to that as local fluency. They were either like second, third, fourth, fifth generation, or even if they were a transplant, they were deeply rooted in the community as school teachers, as part of the rescue squad. So they were very much a locally based candidate. The third thing was they absolutely were willing to be critical of both parties. They were not like, Dems are great, Republicans suck. They recognized both parties had problems with rural. And maybe a fourth big takeaway from that was that they stayed away from high-paid consultants. They used local talent to run their campaigns, to do their media and social media. Some of them raised a good bit of money and were up on TV, but some of the really successful ones did not raise much money and used more of the personal contact.
Yeah, I want to talk specifically about the personal contact and the door knocking. One of the big issues that you took up was when the campaign workers knock on a door, do they start by saying what the candidate's key issues are?
No. Exactly right. So we weren't the only ones to find this. Our study kind of reinforced what other groups who've been doing what some folks call deep canvassing have been advocating for quite some time now, which is to say that the first step after the hello, the first words out of your mouth is, what are the issues on your mind or what do you care about? So it's really a listening posture. That tends to be dismissed by the politically savvy, so-called, because they just don't think there's time for it. Candidates and campaigns are all about how many doors did you knock? How many calls did you make? But if you knocked on 1,000 doors, but you were unsuccessful at 990 of them, what difference does it make? If you knocked on 200 doors, but you have 100 relatively meaningful conversations, you're in much better shape. So that was the key. Listen first. The second thing was that when they spoke in a way that wasn't contradictory. So if the person at the door said some things that, you know, that they didn't agree with, they didn't argue, they didn't scold, but instead they acknowledged that the person had those views and then provided their own views in a way that wasn't like morally superior.
Another key issue here is who should do the door knocking? Do you want to bring in, you know, college students from nearby schools who want to become political activists?
In general, no, but I don't want to discourage because I had college students working on my campaign. Here's the key. If you could, if it's a small enough district like Chloe Maxman had in Maine, then the candidate themselves, himself or herself, is knocking on all the doors. That's only possible from a super committed candidate in a small district. The number two was the candidate knocks on as many doors as possible, and the candidate surrogates are also locally grounded people who kind of know local issues and who have been schooled in this listen first. Then the third level is if you need to bring in volunteers, young aspiring activist college, great, but you must put them through a process so they understand and they come to people at the door in the same way the candidate would, because then they can be helpful to you. If they come like most campaigns train activists to come, they will hurt you more than help you.
And how about arguing that Trump is a threat to democracy and that that's the most important issue facing America today?
Well, you know, there's folks, some fairly prominent advisors and consultants who are arguing that that's the issue. We don't know. What we believe is that saying that Trump is a threat to democracy or that focusing on fascism or anything in that vein might, bit by bit, help rally some otherwise lukewarm liberals and Democrats. There are people who are pretty lukewarm about Biden, for instance, for good and for bad. And maybe that will get a few of them over the top to vote. But outside of that, if your goal is to reach working class and rural people, our research, not our original, but our understanding of the research is that that is not a motivator for most working class and rural people. And the reason isn't because they embrace fascism. It's because a lot of people feel the system has failed them so badly that when somebody says, look, our democracy is under threat, their reaction is, well, the so-called democracy hasn't worked for me and mine in a long time. I mean, I don't think that's that big a deal. So that message doesn't seem to work with people who already feel abandoned by the system.
Joe Biden has gotten at least some of this message. He's trying to campaign at least some in rural America. And so now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Joe Biden visited Northfield, Minnesota, south of St. Paul, in November 2023. This was the beginning of a national tour of rural communities. He went to a Minnesota hog farm where he lamented the loss of family farms. He attacked the corporate consolidation of agriculture. He pledged to oversee a renaissance of the American heartland with $5 billion of funding for agriculture, for rural broadband, for clean energy. And in March 2024, Biden announced a $50 million initiative to support opioid treatment and recovery services in rural communities. So what do you think about these as issues to bring to rural voters?
Well, I'll tell you what, I was a Bernie guy through and through from 2016 on, and I was disappointed when Biden won the nomination. But that said, he has had, for working class and rural, by far the most positive and transformative 3+ years that we've had in my lifetime. I mean, it's not even close, the comparison to Clinton and Obama, for instance, and certainly not the Republicans. So when Biden is going out to rural, when Biden is talking at a hog farm in Minnesota or an old factory town in the Rust Belt, he actually has major accomplishments to tout, not just promises. He's done, in terms of antitrust, a phenomenally aggressive anti-corporate platform. In terms of unions, major changes at the NLRB that are enabling and supporting workers to organize. In terms of small business and family farms, huge investments and some changes, although not enough, in ag policy. So for the first time in forever, a Democratic candidate running for president out in the countryside actually has real substantial things to run on. He just needs to keep that message going, and then we need to see those investments come to life and come to fruition.
And I know next door to Minnesota in Wisconsin, the Democratic Party chair, Ben Wickler, is very proud about the fact that the party now has party organizations in every county with locals running local campaigns year round, not just to get out the vote the last couple of weeks, but before election day. That's also the kind of thing that you think is essential.
Absolutely. What's happening in Wisconsin, the same process appears to be underway in North Carolina under the leadership of Anderson Clayton, and maybe to a lesser degree, but it looks very promising in both Michigan and in Minnesota with Ken Martin. I'm going to be, as I mentioned to you, in Duluth in about 4 or 5 weeks at their state convention. And this whole idea, it's kind of the Howard Dean 50 state strategy translated to a state level. It's the every county strategy. It is still very much the exception. That is not the standard Democratic Party approach, but it's taking root. And when you look at the results in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, in Michigan, you're starting to see that actually this works. If your goal is to elect more Democrats and more progressive politicians, this works. So we are encouraged by that. Ruby,
R-U-B-I,
oh, yeah.
Rural Urban Bridge Initiative.
Sorry. Thank you, John. I just assumed that every person on the planet knew what Ruby was. Yeah, the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative, our experience in research says that if your decision is a sort of a triage, that we can only go to the competitive places, and those are in cities and suburbs, then what you start is a self-fulfilling prophecy where you get like what we got in the 9th district. You go from being competitive to utterly uncompetitive in a matter of just a decade or so. To reverse that means just the opposite. You once again start investing. Your policies, your presence, your investment in local parties and local candidates, even in very red districts. That is a must.
And let's emphasize here, Democrats will not be able to win most rural counties this November. Biden won 32% of the rural vote in 2020, but he can do better. And if he gets a few more votes there, 10,000, 20,000 votes, that can be the margin of victory. It has been the margin of victory in the past in Arizona, in Wisconsin, in Georgia, and it probably will be this November. Any final thoughts, Anthony?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. That margin of victory was probably John Fetterman's reason for success. The fact that Biden got 2% more rural than Hillary Clinton may well have accounted for his victory. And in the battleground states, there is a higher proportion of working class and rural voters, a key subset of whom are persuadable. Biden can do better. Congressional candidates can do better. And it's possible that not only would he win, but we'd retake Congress.
Anthony Flaccavento, his article in the new issue of The Nation magazine is titled, "The Only Thing Worse Than Taking Rural Voters for Granted is Dismissing Them as Out of Reach for Democrats." You can read it online at thenation.com. And you can find out more about the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative, RUBY, at ruralurbanbridge.org. Anthony, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left.
And now, from the archives, an episode recorded in March 2000.
Arthur Danto, art critic for The Nation magazine, has just been nominated for the National Magazine Award for Criticism for his essay on visiting Las Vegas, not to gamble, but to look at the art. I talked to Arthur Danto last year when his cover story first was published. I opened our conversation by remarking that a local reporter had asked whether the paintings now on display in Las Vegas at the Bellagio Gallery of Fine Art were real. This turns out to be an interesting question.
It is interesting that people worry about it. I think there are people who go into the gallery there, I was told by the curator, and ask in a curious way, well, are these real? Maybe they just don't expect that they should be real or anything like that, but it's something that happens, I think, when you're in Las Vegas. Everything is so unreal that it's an easy inference that the paintings have to be something other than real.
But well, remind
a lot of people...
Remind us about what is unreal about Las Vegas.
What's unreal about Las Vegas is everything except art. that is to say, what's at the Bellagio for the most part. I mean, it's an interesting culture. It's an astonishing culture. It's a lot of fun. And if you want, if you're not there as a sort of serious looker at painting, you can have a wonderful time. But what's happened is bringing these extraordinary paintings to Las Vegas has created excitement of a kind that you can't imagine anything else creating. And that to me is an amazing fact. I mean, and Steve Wynn's other hotel out there called the Mirage, they've got Siberian tigers, you can see them. They've got a tank full of sharks, you can see that, and so forth. But there's probably no animal act that they can bring in and justify it by saying, well, this is an endangered species. Nothing you can think of at this point would be like whatever it is, 19 paintings, 26 paintings. I don't know just exactly how many are in that collection, and that ignites such interest in everybody. When I said I was going to Las Vegas, everybody said, "Well, you're going to see the Bellagio. You're going to see the paintings. Is that why you're going?" And it very quickly, it seems to me, has entered national consciousness in a way in which none of the large casino hotels have done. So Steve Wynn was right that there is that interest in great art.
So what are we to make of the fact that some casinos display tigers and sharks and others display Van Gogh and Cezanne? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing?
Well, I wouldn't think it was a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. But I think the difference is that Wynn is somebody set apart, a colleague here at The Nation said, he's like Donald Trump with taste. And it's that idea that he really is a person who's passionate about classical modernism, you might say, and who has figured he was going to get the best advisors he could find, but that whether he made money or not on this, it was something he was going to try. The hope was that he would make money by attracting a different clientele than has been coming to Las Vegas for a very long time, or maybe forever.
You write that Las Vegas has become an art destination. I know that here in Los Angeles, the Museum of Contemporary Art sent a tour group to the Bellagio exhibit, and it was oversubscribed.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I've talked to a lot of people from museums here in New York, and they all say, what a great idea. And they're all planning trips to Las Vegas. So in a funny kind of way, Wynn may have gotten something that he hadn't counted on. I think he might have been hoping that you'd find high rollers with taste, but that may not be what happens. But it doesn't take a lot to support an act in Las Vegas. Somebody told me that the biggest money makers out there are the 5 cent, the nickel slots, and the MGM, which is the largest hotel in the world until about 3 weeks ago, paid for itself out of nickel slots in 4 months.
Gee.
So I don't know what happens with I don't know what's going to happen with the art collection from that point of view. But
Steve Wynn's paintings are for sale, aren't they?
They're all for sale, and I've not gotten to the bottom of that. But from what I understand, he gets a tax break by running a bona fide art gallery, and to run a bona fide art gallery means that everything has to be for sale. And I think that he probably has a very, I have to say, limited sense of how scarce paintings are, because he did sell one of the most magnificent Franz Kleins. I mean, to have gotten a painting like that by you can see it on in my story up at the head. There's a shot of the gallery, and you can see Franz Klein's painting hang on the wall. It's gone. There was a bloody weekend, I guess, in which they sold the Klein, they sold their Giacometti, they sold Mademoiselle Pogani by Brancusi, and there were one other.
Heartbreak.
It is heartbreak, and I think he'll have to find some way around that, although there are certain things to which he's deeply attached, and which he's not selling. However, he can justify that with whatever the tax authorities there are. I'll just tell you what it
Please.
Is. He really adores a portrait of Dora Maar by Picasso. And it was the last painting Picasso did of Dora Maar. It's a great painting. And however many Picassos you've seen, it's worth a trip just to see it.
Arthur Danto, thank you very much for joining us for your report on the art scene in Las Vegas. Arthur Danto is art critic for The Nation magazine. And Arthur Danto has just been nominated for the National Magazine Award for Criticism for his essay on visiting Las Vegas.
We spoke with Arthur Danto in March 2000. He died in 2013. That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.